Keeping in mind that when we came to the end of the beginning of chapter 8, we began a brand new section in the book of Matthew, and it has to do with what is the king of Israel going to be like? And it will emphasize, first of all, his power, and that will be the emphasis in 8:1 through 9:34. In making that emphasis, this is where Matthew centers his miracles, or recording of the miracles, and you have three sets with three each, miracles of healing. Matthew 8, 1 through 17, he heals a leper. He heals a man with paralysis. He heals Peter's mother-in-law who has fever. Then he moves to miracles that simply demonstrate power. Power in the realm of nature. He quiets the sea. We'll get to that tonight. Power in the realm of the supernatural, casting out of demons. Power in the realm of the spiritual. He's able to forgive sins. Then finally, we come to the miracles of restoration, where he restores one to life, one to sight, and one to speech. And that takes up most of the section of Matthew. He's emphasizing the authority and the power of the King of Israel, who is Jesus. Interspersed are little sections on discipleship. And that's what we're looking at in Matthew chapter 8, verses 18 through 22. And it will simply be a section on what are the demands of discipleship. Demands on the disciples. Keep in mind, discipleship is simply a word that means a learner. Anytime you see the word disciple, you have a Greek word that means a learner. And those that are really going to learn from him have to meet certain demands. And first of all, in this little section of verses 18 through 22 of chapter 8, you have, first of all, demands of discipleship in regard to personal possessions. And the emphasis is going to be, if you are going to learn to know me, there can be no guarantee of personal possessions. This comes down to chapter 8, verse 18. Now, when Jesus saw a crowd around him, he gave orders to depart to the other side. And a certain scribe to him and said, "Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go." At this point, we would not know what the man's motivation was, but apparently, when you look at the answer of Jesus, the man's motivation was, this is going to be a rather comfortable life. We may come to the end of the day and find no place to stay, and just like Jesus walks on water, Jesus will say, "Holiday Inn," and it will appear. And everything will be miraculously taken care of, and so forth. And therefore, the idea was, this is a road to glory, and we'd like to take it. And you can tell this is what he had in mind because the Lord reads him and says in verse 20, Jesus said to him, "The foxes have holes, the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." And that is an answer to a man that says, "I want to go with you wherever you go." And therefore, he fails the test of discipleship on the basis of desire for comfort. And the Lord knows that. And when the Lord says, "I have no place to lay my head," the man does not say, "I'll still go, I still want to be a disciple." He fails on the basis of desire for comfort. The second line of teaching is discipleship demands in regard to parental relations. This is the man who wants to go and bury his father. Chapter 8, verse 21. Another of the learners said to him, "Lord, permit me first to go and bury my father." Now, I don't think that means that the man is saying, "My father is now dead, and I would like to go to the funeral. I'd like to make arrangements for his burial." I take it what he's saying is this. Is I want to delay following you until my father dies. In other words, I have this relationship with my parents, and when they're out of the way and the way is clear, then I will go be ready to follow you. And again, the Lord replies by saying, "Follow me, let the dead bury their own dead." The interpretation of verse 20 is probably allow the spiritually dead to bury their own physically dead is probably what he's driving at. But nonetheless, the emphasis is, in this particular case, the man wanted to delay his death or his following Jesus till the death of his father, and of course that could be years. And so, two things about him as to his failure. Number one, he thought discipleship could be picked up at will. Discipleship could be picked up at will. But I think there's more than just that to it. Not only is he saying, I want to do it at my time, which would be that idea, I want to do it under my terms. And that is what he has done. He set conditions. He sets conditions on the Lord's will. And a disciple cannot do that. So he wants to say, I will be a disciple when I am ready, and I want to tell you how I will serve you. Setting conditions. And the Lord is going to say, of course, no to both of those. The idea obviously involved here is that discipleship involves immediate, total committal to the Lord without respect to other relationships, without respect to time, without respect to your own conditions, and without respect to your own personal possessions. And of course, as you can well see at this point, he didn't pick up any new followers. All right, from the demands of disciples now, we go back to emphasis on the miracles of power. It's a third, three clusters of three each. Miracles of power. And the miracles of power are 8:23 through 9:8. And we have three of them. Number one, in the realm of nature. Matthew is establishing that Jesus has authority over all of these areas. Authority over nature, over the spirit world, authority over all sorts of things. This is the point he's making at this point in the book. So first of all, in the realm of nature, and that is 8:23 through 27. And let's start out with the setting. Verse 23, or 24 rather. It says, behold, there arose a great storm in the sea, so that the boat was covered with the waves, but he himself was asleep. Now, it's interesting to note that when he calls this thing a great storm, it's really not a word that is used for storm. It's a word that I think when I write it out, you will recognize as one that we have in English. It is the word seismos, S-E-I-S-M-O-S. Which does not mean storm, it means shaking. We have some equipment called a seismograph, and it's used to measure shaking, such as in a earthquake. And therefore, what he is doing is looking at the storm from the standpoint of what was happening. And so the idea is they got out there in the boat, and they got one great shake. Or one great shaking, and it would be the idea of the tossing and the turning of the waves, and perhaps you can see the boat down in the at the bottom of a wave and so forth. And so you have this enormous shaking, probably a thunderstorm, that would describe it well, so that the boat was covered, but he himself was asleep. Now, from that, the Lord gives the disciples a rebuke. And the rebuke comes in 8:25 and 26. 25, they came to him and woke him, saying, save us, Lord, we're perishing. And he said to them, why are you timid, you men of little faith? There is a word that is used here that is recorded four times. It must have really struck Matthew. The word men of little faith is one Greek word that looks like this. It is O-L-I-G, O-P-I-S-T-O-S. And notice it is one single word, polygapistos. And it's made up of the noun pistos, which is faith. And it is welded together into a compound with the word holagos that means tiny. We last time called it, tried to think of one single English noun, which of course, if you've got a single noun in Greek, you'd like to translate it with a single noun. And, of course, our translators have not. They have just come up with, why are you timid, halagapistos, and the translation comes up with, you men of little faith. Now, it's true, lots of times you do have to take a single noun or a word and translate it with several words in English. But I don't think we have to do that here. How about the one we used last time, which was many-faithed? Or someone came up afterwards and said, people on tape will think maybe that you're saying M-A-N-Y faith. So in the age of computers, why don't we go with micro-faithed? That would do it too. So we'll go with micro-faith. And on three different occasions, Matthew records how the Lord turned to them and pointed the finger and says, you men are all micro-faithed. Now, we've got that then in this particular area, and let's look at the four times that it is used. First of all, and find out in what particular areas are they micro-faith. Going to the first one, Matthew 6 and verse 30. Matthew 6, verse 30. Matthew records it four times on four different occasions, and we'll want to see in what sense were they micro-faithed. What couldn't they really trust the Lord for? Matthew chapter 6 and verse 30 is the first. In Matthew 6 verse 30, he says, if God so arrays the grass of the field, which is alive today and tomorrow is thrown into the furnace, will he not much more do for you also, micro-faithed? You micro-faithed. And so the first emphasis is simply on, will God clothe and feed you? So they are micro-faithed in terms of the need for daily food and clothing. And that, of course, is not a major thing, and though it's important, the second is in Matthew 8:26 that we just looked at. And Matthew 8:26 is not in a food or daily need type of situation. Matthew 8:26 is a case where their lives are in danger. And that's where you have verse 25, they awoke him. Save us, Lord, we're perishing. And, of course, back in the other thing on the daily need, they were not perishing. It was not a big crisis. But here, it is a big crisis. And he said to them, why are you timid? And then micro-faithed. So you have in Matthew 8:26 is a life-threatening crisis. Now, what is that saying? It is giving us something about the scope of their micro-faith. You don't trust me anywhere from daily need clear up to a crisis. You don't trust me when you're in a crisis, and you don't trust me on a day-to-day need basis. The first one in Matthew 6:30 would be on a day-to-day basis for daily needs. Matthew 8:26 would be probably a once or twice in a lifetime crisis. So this one would be rare, this one would be common. When the crisis comes up, as it does rarely, but it does occasionally, you're micro-faithed. And when it comes to getting up Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, you're still micro-faithed. In other words, the scope of it is all the way from the daily needs clear up to the crisis points. Third, Matthew 14. Matthew 14. And this is verses 28 through 31. Got an interesting sequence here. The Lord appears to them walking on the water, and they are afraid. And in verse 27, it says, immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, take courage, it is I, do not be afraid. And Peter answered him and said, Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water. And he said, come. Peter got out of the boat, walked on the water, and came toward Jesus. But seeing the wind, he became afraid, and beginning to sink, he cried out, saying, Lord, save me. And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and took hold of him and said, O what? Micro faith. Why do you doubt? Notice, by the way, the sequence. The sequence involves several things. It involves five things. They're very practical because they still work. Number one, notice in verse 29, you've got an initial burst of faith. The Lord says, Peter, it's I. Come on and meet me. And Peter is out of the boat and on the water. So you have an initial burst of faith. Peter met the challenge and he believed the Lord. Following the initial burst of faith, what happens? Well, verse 29, the Lord said, come. Peter got out of the boat, walked on the water, came toward Jesus. What are the next five words? But seeing the wind. So the second step, you've got a great burst of faith. Everything is great. And then second, he sees the wind. That'll do it every time, won't it? Coming along great. And then you see the pressures that are involved. You see how really difficult it is. It's much like, I've never done this and I never will, but saying when you climb up a long, long, long ladder or tower, don't look down. And the emphasis is if you keep looking right where you are, you begin to look down and peek, and pretty soon you're going to be frozen. That's exactly what Peter did. He started to climb a ladder and he looked down. And as soon as he did that, he was impeded immediately. He sees the wind, and what follows? He became afraid. So, three, emotion takes over. A burst of faith. He looks at the wind, looks at the problem, looks at the circumstances. Emotion takes over, and what happens? As soon as emotion takes over, in verse 30, seeing the wind, became afraid, and beginning to sink. He sinks. Does this illustrate anything that any of us have ever been through? You know, there's a great burst of faith, I'm going to trust the Lord. Then you begin to see the circumstances, and then you get uptight, and emotion takes over, and you begin to sink. Fifth, the Lord lets him drown. I'd love to know, how far down did he get? Did the Lord get him at his waist, or did he get up to his chin? I don't know how far down he went. But that isn't the case. Notice what the Lord does. The Lord takes hold in verse 31. Immediately Jesus stretched out his hand, took hold of him, and said to him, O micro faith, why do you doubt? So the Lord does not let him drown. Cross that out. The Lord states his problem. The Lord saves and teaches. Saves him out of the mess and teaches him what his problem is. I won't let you drown, and I'm going to tell you what your problem is. Finally, and fourth reference is Matthew chapter 16, verse 8. Matthew loves to use this word, microfaith. The other gospel writers don't. I guess they didn't care for it. Matthew 16, verse 8, they are having a discussion concerning bread, and Jesus says in verse 8, but Jesus, aware of this, said, you men of little faith or micro faith, why do you discuss among yourselves because you have no bread? So we make an interesting cycle. The first one in Matthew 6:30 is for a daily need, and then it goes to a crisis. Then in Matthew 14, we go to a crisis again, in the Sea of Galilee, and then we go back in Matthew 16:18 to the bread situation again. So we go from bread to crisis, crisis back to bread again in this cycle. All right, now let's go back to the passage we're looking at. Matthew 8. Okay, we got the rebuke of the disciples, and now you have the rebuke of the winds. verse 26 of Matthew 8. And he said to them, "Why are you timid, you men of little faith?" Then he arose and rebuked the winds. Now, there's an interesting thing at this point, and it's found in what he did, or the verb that expressed his activity toward the storm, which is the word rebuke. Keep your finger here and go to Matthew 17, because there are two entities that the Lord rebukes. One of them is the storm, and it's very interesting that he uses the same verb, and the rebuke involves the doing of a wrong. And therefore, it is something that is used in regard to demons. Chapter 17 and verse 18, where it says, Jesus rebuked him. And the rebuke, again, involves wrongdoing. And the wrongdoing is on part of a demon. He rebuked the demon, and the demon came out of him, and the boy was cured at once. So you have the phenomena that the Lord finds fault and rebukes the demon. He also does the same thing to the sea, which would make you think, then, that this is strongly implying, if not teaching, that behind the raging storm is the activity of Satan. And then ultimately, in the rebuke of the storm, it is a rebuke of Satan himself. Notice, going back to chapter 8, how the disciples respond to all of this. Verse 27. Now, Matthew changes something here. Up till this point, they have been called the disciples. But notice, if he follows his normal pattern, when you come to verse 27, he would say, "And the disciples marvel." That's what he's been calling them all along, the disciples. But he changes to calling them the men. And you would ask and want to know, why does Matthew change to saying, instead of calling them disciples and him among them, why does he now call them men? And I take it that in the light of the greatness of this miracle, the fact that they were nothing more than mere helpless men became obvious. And therefore, in the light of his awesome power, it became obvious that we are nothing but men. And is there anything that can make you feel more of just a man than some enormous phenomena like a storm or something that short, when you realize your weakness? On the other hand, the idea in the latter part of verse 27 is that here is a man, but he's a man completely unlike us, and therefore the statement, "What kind of man is this, that even the winds and the sea obey him?" Emphasis then is on the authority of Jesus, and here is authority of Jesus in the realm of nature. This is the point Matthew is trying to make. Jesus has the authority that the Messiah will have. Now, we move to the second one, and that's authority in the realm of the supernatural. Authority in the realm of nature, now in the realm of the supernatural. Matthew 8, 28 through 34. Now, when we come to 8:28, we're coming to a casting out of demons, which says, when he had come to the other side of the country of the Gadarenes, two men who were demon-possessed met him. And let me say three things about demons in the Gospels. And there are three important things. I'll just put three basics about teaching concerning demons. Four things. Number one is this. Their reality is assumed. No place does Jesus attempt to prove their existence. Their existence and their reality is assumed. Just like you begin Genesis 1:1, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth." The existence of God is assumed. It is not attempted to be proved. Second fact, whenever you have the words "demon possessed" in the Gospels, that translation is questionable, simply because "demon possessed" is the translation of one single word, which is a present tense participle. Well, you can't translate it with just one word. I would put it this way. Being demonized. That is literal. And when you come then to verse 28, and this is true of all of the demon-possessed statements in the Gospels, when you come to that and you come to the fact that two men were demon-possessed, I think it would be better, rather than some of the associations that go along with possessed, take it in terms of two men who were being demonized. It simply means that they were the center of demonic activity. They were animated by, they were moved by, and they were acted upon demons. Third, by the way, it's important sometimes to get, important always to get a balance. When you talk about those that are being demonized, that is basically a feature of the ministry of Christ. It is not a basic feature of the church age. And the reason I argue that is go to the book of Ephesians, and where does he discuss anyone being demonized? He does not. Or Romans, or Galatians, or 1 Corinthians, or 2 Corinthians, or Colossians, or the pastoral epistles. He talks about giving no place to the devil. He talks about principalities and powers against which we do battle in Ephesians 6. But as far as being demonized or demon-possessed, that is primarily a phenomena that you find in the Gospels, and it's also a phenomena that you find in prophecy that comes about again in association with Christ's second coming. His appearances bring about the flurry of demonism. Now, some will say, well, what the New Testament is calling demon possession is what people in those times thought they were calling a person demon-possessed who was a mental psychotic or had a mental problem. And that does not fit for this reasons. The demons are addressed as separate from the person that they inflict. They are addressed as separate entities from the person they possess. I'll just put for shortness on the overhead. They are addressed as separate entities. Good example of that is Mark 1:23. Mark 1. Notice the passage here will address the demons separately from the persons they possess. Verse 23, and just then there was in their synagogue a man with an unclean spirit. And he cried out, saying, what do we have to do with you, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God. And Jesus rebuked him, saying, be quiet and come out of him. Notice right there, very clear. You, demon, be quiet. And you, demon, come out of him, which is a reference to the person. And therefore you've got, verse 26, throwing him into convulsions, the unclean spirit cried out with a loud voice and came out of him. Separate entity addressed as separate entities. So it's a very real type thing, and it is not what simply the first century conception of what was wrong with people who had mental problems. Second or fourth thing we want to note is that the New Testament makes a distinction between a malady, physical malady, that may be caused by a demon and one that is not. So let's put this. Some maladies are treated as demon-caused. Some are not. Some maladies are demon-caused. Some are not. Let me give you two cases. And in each case, we'll have the same malady. And the malady will be found in, first of all, Matthew 9:32. And if you're still in Mark, keep that because we'll come back to Mark. A distinction is made between a malady that is demon-caused and one that is not. Matthew 9:32. And here's a man with a malady. He is dumb, and he is demon-possessed. Verse 32. And as they were going out, behold, a dumb man, that's the malady, physical malady, demon-possessed, was brought to him. And after the demon was cast out, the dumb man spoke, and the multitudes marveled, saying, nothing like this was ever seen in Israel. So connected with his dumbness was the idea that it was connected with demons. However, look at Mark chapter 7, 32. And you have a case where you had a malady, the same malady, but it was not, no implication that there was any demon problem involved here. Chapter 7, verse 32 says, they brought to him one who was deaf and spoke with difficulty, or dumb. And they entreated him to lay his hand upon him, and he took him aside from the multitude by himself, put his fingers in his ears, and after spitting, he touched his tongue with the saliva. And looking up to heaven with a deep sigh, he said to them, Ephatha, that is, be opened, and his ears were opened, and the impediment of this man, of his tongue was removed, and he began speaking plainly. And notice there is no implication of any demon involvement. No demons are cast out. The Lord simply effects a healing. So that gives us basis, and there are many other passages that are the same, for saying that some maladies are demon-caused, some are not. Those are basics as far as demon possession in the New Testament or in the Gospels is concerned. Now let's go to the event. Matthew chapter 8. One of the characteristics of demons is their orthodoxy. And the orthodoxy of demons is seen in Matthew 8, 29. And they will bear testimony, orthodox testimony, in three areas. Verse 29. 28, again, to get the setting. When he had come to the other side of the country of the Gadarenes, two men who were demon-possessed met him as they were coming out of the tombs. They were exceedingly violent, so that no one could pass by that road. And behold, they cried out, saying, what have we to do with you, Son of God? So, they first of all bear testimony to Jesus' person. Notice they immediately call him Son of God. Son of God may be taken as equivalent to Messiah. The Pharisees and the scribes did not grasp that Jesus was the Messiah of Israel. Demons did. Now let me establish that connection with two passages. First of all, staying in Matthew chapter 16. To call him Son of God is equivalent to calling him Messiah. He has just asked the disciples who he is. Verse 15 of Matthew 16, he said to them, but who do you say that I am? And Simon Peter answered and said, you are the Messiah. Who's the Messiah? He is the Son of the living God. Notice the terms. To be the Messiah is to be the Son of God. And even clearer yet, Luke 4, 41. Luke 4, 41. Again, it's demon testimony. And notice in this verse, to know him as the Son of God is to know him as the Messiah. Verse 41, it says, demons also were coming out of many, crying out and saying, you are the Son of God. And rebuking them, he would not allow them to speak because they knew him to be the Messiah. So notice, to be the Son of God is to be the Messiah. To be the Messiah is to be the Son of God. Even though there are nuances involved in each word, it's slightly different. But nonetheless, they are giving an orthodox testimony as to the person of Jesus. Okay, they bear testimony to his person. Second, and going back to our Matthew passage in chapter 8, in their question, they said, have you come here to torment us before the time? They give an orthodox testimony not only to his person, but to Jesus' power. They do not debate his ability to judge them. Third, in the first part of verse 29, they cried out saying, "What do we have to do with you?" And I'll explain those words in just a moment, but this is going to be an orthodox testimony to Jesus' uniqueness. Uniqueness relative to them. The words that are translated, "What do we have to do with you?" Are literally this. What to you, or what to us, and to you. Now that's obviously an idiom. Translating it literally, it is what to us and to you. And it was simply an idiom that means total divergence. It's an idiom equal to stating total divergence. It is demons saying, "We have nothing whatsoever in common with you." And that, of course, on the positive side, would be asserting the uniqueness of Jesus. So they're orthodox as to person and to power and as to uniqueness of the Lord as far as his person is concerned. Now, another thing about this confrontation here in verse 29 is this. This is, in the book of Matthew, the first stated opposition to the Lord. In the book of Matthew. You have had the presence of the Pharisees, but you have never had a confrontation of opposition to this point of time. Now, I think what this does then is, since this is the first confrontation in the book of Matthew with Jesus, it's interesting to note that it is satanic in nature. So, what this is going to set the tone for, this will be the tone that tells us the nature of Israel's rejection of her Messiah. It was satanic. And again, I think it is noteworthy that the first time the author begins to bring in the fact, and he's going to build on this now from here on to the climactic part of the book, which will be the crucifixion of Christ, he's going to begin to bring in little spots of opposition, and Matthew selecting as he did, what are you going to look as the first thing in your book of opposition to the Lord? And he's going to say, I'm going to bring in, first thing in my book, the opposition of demons. And I take it the reason is that this is going to state the nature and the character of opposition to the Lord that's going to be coming down in the rest of the book. Now, notice what follows in the context. Verse 30, there was at a distance from them a herd of many swine feeding. And the demons began to entreat him, saying, if you are going to cast us out, send us into the herd of swine. Now notice two elements. If you're going to cast us out by your power, then send us into the herd of swine. And the important thing, I think, to note at this particular point is the Lord cast them out, but he did not command them to enter the swine. So the Lord cast them out, but did not command them to enter the swine. While much of his theology I would totally disagree with, Thomas Aquinas made an interesting statement on this particular miracle. He said, note that the swine were driven into the sea. That was no work of divine miracle, but was the work of the devils by divine permission. And the emphasis, again, is simply noting that while he cast them out with an order, he did not command them to enter the swine. In fact, I think it's one of the other accounts, I believe it's Mark, uses the word in connection with entering the swine that Jesus permitted them. So he did not have a direct command in this particular context. Now, people often say, well, look, he cast the demons out. They went into the swine. The swine, verse 32, I notice again, verse 32, he said to them, be gone. That's casting out of the demons. And they came out, went into the swine. That would be by permission. And behold, the whole herd rushed down the street bank into the sea and perished in the waters. And the argument that comes up is, what right did the Lord have to do to take away the livelihood of these men? The people that were taking care of the swine and the pigs They didn't have anything to do with this. They were not the demon-possessed one. What right did he have to take their property and see their whole livelihood go into the sea? And I think there are several answers to that. The first one is this, and it's a premise that I believe we have to accept, which is this. The Creator has a right to dispose of His own creatures as He chooses for His own end without giving man an explanation. Okay? You think God can do that as Creator? May God use His own creation any way He wishes without giving me explanation. If He would like suddenly for dogs to walk on their back legs all of the time, and we go out tomorrow and all the dogs are erect and walking on their back legs, does God have such a right? Or may we say, Lord, my dog always walked on all fours, and You have no right to do this to me? Obviously not. He's the Creator. The Creator has the right to use His creation as He will. But I think there's something more. And I'll just draw it out as a couple of lessons from the swine incident. Pointed lessons, especially the second one. Notice in verse 32, reading it again, He said to them, "Be gone." And they came out and went into the swine. And behold, the whole herd rushed down the steep bank into the sea and perished in the waters. Lesson number one. This shows the demon-possessed men the end from which they had been saved. It shows the men the end from which He had saved them. The end, obviously, was death, perishing. And the Lord very vividly, obviously the men that had been healed would be deeply grateful. Look what the demons did. They drove the swine into the sea, and the swine or the pigs perished. And therefore, thank the Lord for the end from which He has saved us. But there's a second thing. It gave the city from which these men came an opportunity to recognize true values. Gave the city an opportunity, really, to see how sick and twisted and horrible their values were. But putting it on a positive note, it gave the city an opportunity to recognize true values. Now let's see this by reading what happened following this incident, or as part of this incident, verse 33. And the herdsmen fled and went away to the city and reported everything, including the incident of the demoniacs. Now remember, these men had been so demon-possessed back in verse 28 that no one would even go down this road. Here's a road with demon-possessed men, so that nobody even utilized the road, and roads weren't that abundant in those times. And so it's like these guys have shot off I-35, so we'll go over the ASB bridge in order to get home. And you would think then that when these herdsmen come to the city, and went to the city, and they reported everything, including the incident of the demoniacs, behold, the whole city came out to meet Jesus. And when they saw Him, they entreated Him to depart from their region. Now, look here at one other thing. Go over to get the forces. Matthew chapter 5, parallel account, Mark 5, rather, verses 14 through 17. Mark 5, 14 through 17. The same event. It says, those who tended them ran away and reported it in the city and out in the country. And what I want you to know here is Mark will tell us when the city came out there what they saw. And the people came to see what it was that had happened. And they came to Jesus and observed the man who had been demon-possessed sitting down, clothed, in his right mind. Now you would think, if you had any human kindness whatsoever, you would say, well, we ought to be thankful. Here are these men that were so bad are now sitting, they're clothed, and in their right mind. But notice, even though they see that, Mark also records verse 17, they began to entreat Him to depart from their region. Now, taking that back, it's interesting to note that no one was grateful to see the man well. They were only filled with anger and consternation, because we lost our pigs. And so really, the issue is Jesus or pigs? And they went with pigs. Probably it hurt the economy. And if Jesus hurts the economy, we'll take the economy, not Jesus. And this again is the materialistic. And what have they got? An opportunity to see this man seated. To think, what a shabby set of values we've got. Some pigs have gone into the lake and drowned. And here's a man in his right mind. So materialistic that even human welfare was not as important than their pigs. All right, let's set up a caption then. And I'm not going to start going any further with it, but it will be Chapter 9, Jesus' Authority. Now, this is our set of three miracles. We've looked at two tonight. His authority over nature with the stilling of the storm. His authority over the supernatural in casting out of the demons. And now we will have the forgiveness of sins, or he has authority in the realm of the spiritual. And we will pick up at that point. And then we'll have another little section on discipleship. And then we'll go to three more miracles. And these will be miracles of restoration that will come next. Father, we're thankful tonight for your word. We're thankful for Matthew's careful demonstration of who Jesus Christ is. And as we move into this next miracle that will tie him in particular into the fulfillment of the prophecies in the Old Testament, particularly in the book of Isaiah concerning who the Messiah should be, that we will see the historical proof that he is indeed as Jesus. He is truly the Messiah of Israel, the Christ. And therefore, as we see who he is, may we see the folly of their rejection and the importance of coming to know him in Christ's name.